Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Hello and welcome to SCOTUScast. I'm your host, Justin Drewer, on behalf of the Faculty Division of the Federalist Society. We're here today to discuss Delaware v. Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, which was argued before the court on October 3rd. It's my honor to introduce our guest today, Professor Donald Koshin, who is a professor of law and the deputy executive director of the Law and Economics Center at the Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University. So to start off about why this case matters, why it should be of interest to you, I'll hand things over to Professor Koshin to kick us off.
Thank you, Justin, and thank you to the Federalist Society for holding this SCOTUScast. I'm excited to talk about this case. It may seem like a non-exciting case. It may seem like a rather obscure technical case of what constitutes what kind of financial transaction and what constitutes a check or what constitutes a money order, which we may not seem to care much about. But I want to just sort of start by raising the idea that this actually could be a big case across a number of different areas. First off, it's important in its own right to resolve the particular controversy before the court between these states, and it does have high stakes. It's about which state gets to keep hundreds of millions of dollars, which can end up being quite a significant outcome. And so that allocation issue between the states is important for that financial reason. But there's also a big issue of matter of statutory interpretation here, particularly a clause which says other similar instruments. And we'll get to that, I think, when we have our discussion. And how do you interpret a statute which has a catch-all kind of provision, including what kind of things inform our understanding of similar for determining what gets covered by a clause? I think that that statutory interpretation issue might have an impact on a variety of different statutes, which include similar kind of similarity language. Then there's the role of the presumption against displacement of the common law, and whether or not we should read statutes based on that maxim. And I think that this case is one that will need to address that question in terms of defining the scope of the statute at issue. There's also equity and federalism concerns between the states and whether or not those should inform the interpretation, including whether or not the purposes of the statute, which was designed to further equity between the states, should inform that similarity discussion to figure out what kind of instruments this covers. And then, finally, although certainly not the only last thing, is it does help us to understand a little bit more about the abandonment of personal property. So with that, I hope I've kept some people interested to listen to the specifics of the case, and I'll turn it back to you.
All right. Thank you for that. Hopefully, this keeps people's attention. I think this is a good format that we can explore. That was a good idea to kick off like that. So kind of bringing us back to the kind of beginning of the case, maybe before we get to those specifics, what is the kind of background of this case? How did we get to this point?
Sure. It's Delaware versus Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, and it's consolidated with Arkansas versus Delaware. And that's important after we get to the discussion of the oral argument, because the oral argument was argued on behalf of Delaware by Neil Katyal of Hogan's Lovell and the former acting Solicitor General of the United States. And the other states argument was argued at the oral argument by Nicholas Brawny, who's the Solicitor General of the state of Arkansas. So to understand why Solicitor Brawny is there, it's important to know that Arkansas was involved in this as well. So it is an abandoned property case. It is a question of whether or not abandoned property escheats to one state or another. The issues in the case are first, whether a MoneyGram official check, which is a technical designation on certain MoneyGram instruments, are money orders, traveler checks, or other similar written instruments other than a third-party bank check on which a banking or financial organization or a business association is directly liable pursuant to 12 U.S.C. 2503, which is the Federal Disposition of Abandoned Money Orders and Traveler's Check Act. Now, the second question then is whether the court should command Wisconsin and Pennsylvania not to assert any claim over abandoned property and unclaimed property related to MoneyGram official checks, because they should go to Delaware. And then the third is whether all future sums payable on abandoned MoneyGram official checks should be remitted to Delaware. So, you know, in an ongoing basis, where should this allocation lie? In a third-party complaint by Pennsylvania, they also seek to apply the act, that is the Disposition Act, and have it control. Or if the act does not apply, then they want to modify this federal common law priority rule that was set forth in a 1965 case in Texas versus New Jersey. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the precedents, because you really can't understand this case unless you understand the precedents. So let's get back to sort of the overview, and then I'll get into those precedents that the court is struggling with. So what are these transactions that are at dispute in the case? Mostly these are disputes between several states over which state should keep the abandoned property. In other words, to which state should unclaimed or uncashed checks issued by MoneyGram payments systems escheat. And escheat is the process by which, if you have a property where there is no claimant, then it escheats to the state or goes to the state. When something escheats to the state, technically the state is holding it in trust for whoever actually has a claim to that property. Although over time, you may run out of time to make a claim against the state to the trust, and it may just go into the general state coffers. Much of the property that escheats to the state never gets distributed to anyone else. And so the states see the sheeted property as a way to basically fund their operations, right? This is an important financial stake for these states. So MoneyGram is the largest provider of money orders in the country. And in addition to money orders, the company also issues these official checks, which are for larger amounts and sold at financial institutions instead of what we might think of as layman as the money orders, which are, the small dollar transactions. And the state of Delaware wants us to focus on the definition of money order as being sort of those small dollar transactions where the bank isn't involved in this big financial aspect. So, there's been an enduring dispute over these abandoned MoneyGram official checks, specifically two types of these official checks. One are called agent checks, and the others are called teller checks under this category. These, whether or not they should remit to Delaware where MoneyGram is incorporated, that would be the common law rule. Okay, so if there's no address for it to go to, then it would go to the place where the debtor was incorporated, or whether it should go to the states where the checks were purchased. And this is the 2503 rule, which seeks to abrogate the common law rule by statute and say, no, actually, we want it to go wherever the transaction occurred when we can't find the actual creditor. Again, this is only when we can't find the creditor, we don't know the address, we don't know who to send it to, and it's been abandoned. So the history behind this is interesting, and it really is about a number of states in around 2015 and 2016, starting with Pennsylvania and some other states, began suing Delaware in federal court, seeking this return of the funds. Delaware claims that the uncashed official check should be escheated to the state where the check issuer or debtor is incorporated, and that no statutory rule under 2503 applies because these are not instruments covered by 2503. Again, 2503 only covers money orders or traveler's checks. And so if these are not money orders or traveler's checks that we're talking about, these agents' checks and teller's checks, then the statute wouldn't apply. If they are, then the statute applies, which means that instead of going back to the common law rule, we have to go to the statutory rule, which is that the money that's been abandoned goes to the state where the MoneyGrams or these instruments, let's not presume that they're MoneyGrams, right, were actually issued. Delaware moved to dismiss these cases on May 26, 2016, they filed a motion with the U.S. Supreme Court requesting leave to file a bill of complaint against other states regarding a sheetment of uncashed official checks, and they claim the court had exclusive and original jurisdiction under Article 3, Section 2, and under 28 U.S.C. 1251A. So back to the basics for a little bit. I'll tell you a little bit about the basics of property law and what we would normally require, and then see how the precedents filled out. And then I'll turn it over to you to talk more about to ask me what you'd like to hear about more about the case. But under the basic rule of finders of abandoned property, and you know, go back to your first year course, owners who relinquish their rights in some way, the first to acquire the property generally gets full rights to the thing. Statutes may govern what it means to acquire, and under common law rules, an uncashed check typically escheats to the state of the creditor's last known address. There's a secondary rule that was developed in Texas versus New Jersey, a 1965 Supreme Court case, which we're going to talk about, and I'll spend a couple minutes on in just a minute. But suffice it to say, in that case, it established general rules of priority that said if there's an unclaimed property with an unknown owner address, then it should be escheated to the state where the holder is incorporated or where the debtor is incorporated. All right. So this goes, again, back to that common law rule. Nonetheless, there is a common law maxim, mobilia sequentur personam, under which intangible personal property may be found to follow the domicile of the owner. And here the owner is the creditor, the person to whom the moneygram is issued. The debtor or the issuer does not have an entitlement to property. The creditor does. So it would normally just go to the creditor's state if we could find it. But the problem is we don't have addresses. And this is where this is the small category of cases that we're trying to address in this case. So what are the three key precedents involved here? One is these are all the precedents resolving disputes between which a state claims priority to claim certain abandoned intangible personal property. So the three cases are Delaware versus New York at 507 U.S. 490, 1993, and then Pennsylvania versus New York at 407 U.S. 206, 1972, and Texas versus New Jersey. The Texas versus New Jersey case that established what are called the priority rules, which are at issue in this case, Delaware versus Pennsylvania and Wisconsin. The real issue Texas versus New Jersey case was how do we resolve things when we don't have these addresses? So where by the first opportunity to escheat, the property belongs to the state of the last known address of the creditor, that would be the normal case. If we have an address, we go to the last known address of the creditor. And we'll look to the debtor's books and records, and this is called the primary rule. And if it does, it goes to the creditor. If we don't have that address, we get dumped into the secondary rule. But let's talk about the primary rule for a minute, because it's important to see how much the primary rule is going to be a focal point for the court in this case. Justice Powell later explained the rationale for this primary rule in the 1972 case of Pennsylvania versus New York in his dissent, which was joined by Justices Blackmun and Rehnquist. So he's talking about why they got to the primary rule in Texas versus New Jersey and gives an informative statement in saying, in looking to the residence of the creditor, the rule adopted by the court recognized that the company's unclaimed debts were assets of the individual creditors rather than assets of the debtor. So who should it better go to if we like to look to the creditor, and if it should therefore go to the creditor's state if we have that address but can't find the creditor themselves. Justice Powell also noted that there's the primary rule better reflects the distribution of property. And I think that this is the equitable claim that you saw come out a lot in the oral argument in this case, is how should property of abandoned property be distributed? Because ultimately, if Delaware wins here, there's going to be a high concentration of a sheeted property from money orders all going to Delaware, because MoneyGram is the dominant player in this field and MoneyGram is incorporated in Delaware. Other similar companies are all incorporated in Delaware. So you're going to get a big amount out of this sheet to Delaware, and instead of a distribution across all the states where all these different creditors might exist, if you try to go to other states. So Powell notes that what we want to do by giving it to the creditors is also achieve this kind of equitable distribution. He, in his 1972 dissent, again, in that Pennsylvania versus New York case, he said, quote, in distributing the property among the creditor states, the rule had the advantage of dividing the property in a manner roughly proportionate to the commercial activities of each state's residents. And using the last known address as the sole indicator of domicile, the rule would be easy to administer and apply. Now, again, that's talking about the primary rule when we have the creditor's address. When we don't have the creditor's address, then there's this possibility that it either all gets concentrated again in a different way, or we could adopt a Powell-like rule, which would say we want it distributed amongst another way. And the way that the Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Arkansas are arguing for is that we should go the way of the statute. The way of the statute was that we have the transactions, we look to the origin of the purchase, and we distribute the assets to the states in which they were purchased, rather than to the state of the actual debtor. So the next rule came out in 1965 in Texas versus New Jersey to deal with that no address of the creditor. And they said, look, we're still going to have the primary rule, but the secondary rule will be that if there's no record of any address for a creditor, or because the creditor's last known address is in a state which does not provide for the escheatment of property, abandoned property, the property escheats to the state in which the debtor is incorporated. The court really seemed to be trying to do equity here. It was trying to find some solution that could identify as fair to the owner. But there's no reason to believe the secondary rule is compelled by the common law or by principles of property. Mostly the court was just trying to find an equitable solution. Justice Powell, again, later dissent, did note that the secondary category was expected to be small. And that 1972 case in Pennsylvania versus New York really kind of sets forth the state's argument here, the Pennsylvania, Arkansas, and in the dissent. Again, as I'm saying, Powell's kind of giving us the reason for the dissent, reasons in the dissent. And in that case, the court expressly rejected going to a different rule in which the secondary priority rule would apply a sheeting to the different states, and instead said that the state of the, you know, rejected the state of the origin of the transaction argument and said, let's stick with Texas versus New Jersey's rule. The consequences of this extension, Powell recognized as the following, and I think quoting this at length is somewhat useful because it does sum up. If the court decides to argue that this is the purpose for the 2503 statute, Powell's dissent, because the 2503 responds to the 72 and case. It says, look, we don't like the outcome of that and we want something different. And the question is, do the instruments in this case, Delaware versus Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, are these the kind of instruments Congress covered in that statute that was responsive to this case? So let's look at Powell's concern with this case, which is consistent with what we might expect Congress's concern to have been. Quote, effectively then, the obligation of the debtor will be converted into an asset of the debtor's state of domicile to the exclusion of the creditor's state. The court in Texas versus New Jersey specifically repudiated this result on the ground that it was inconsistent with principles of fairness. It would have exalted a minor factor to permit a sheet of obligations incurred all over the country by the state in which the debtor happened to incorporate itself. The fact that the court was willing to permit this result in the few cases in which no record of address was available or in which no law of a sheet governed does not diminish the clear view of the court that this result would be impermissible as a basis for disposing of more than a small minority of the debts. Yet the decision today ignores the court's unwillingness to exalt the largely coincidental domicile of the corporate debtor. It also disregards the court's clearly expressed intent that the escheatable property be distributed in proportions roughly comparable to the volume of transactions conducted in each state. So Congress seemed to agree with this and pass 2503. And the 2503 language we've already set out. The real question then is whether or not that language applies. And obviously that is the principal area where the oral argument focused.
So I think that sets us up perfectly to move into talking about the oral argument. So what are your takeaways from the oral argument? Any kind of good clarifications that happened, or you know, which side do you think kind of had the more convincing arguments? Where you think this is headed? I'd be interested to hear your views on that.
Yeah. So I after listening to the questioning, you know, most of the questioning actually came from Justice Thomas, Justice. There was a fair amount from Justice Alito, and then there was a fair amount, a little bit from Roberts, and I would say Justice Brown Jackson had quite a few questions as well. There weren't too many questions from others. There was one small category, you know, a question from Kavanaugh and one from Sotomayor, a couple from Kagan, but it wasn't a particularly active bench, and the justices did not seem to tip their hand much. There also wasn't a lot of sharp questioning that was designed to, you know, expose critical weaknesses in any of the arguments. Well, the justices really did seem to be searching for a greater understanding of how the arguments were being formulated on each side, and particularly definitional arguments. And so I think they're struggling with trying to figure out, one, what is the definition of a money order? Two, what is the definition of similar instrument? And three, how do you actually populate that category of similar? What are the tools for doing so? And is it primarily a linguistic exercise that looks to the meaning of the other terms? Should it be a functional exercise that looks at functional equivalency between different things? And I think really what both attorneys were arguing for is to also interpret the word similar based in part on the purposes of the statutory intervention here. That is, that the purposes themselves, beyond the linguistic similarity between the terms, you should also be looking at what kind of purposes was Congress trying to serve in the statute to determine whether or not something is similar or not. So let me just kind of tell you, I'll summarize each side's argument, which really kind of summarizes their arguments in the briefs as well, as to how do we get to a resolution of each of those issues. So the Delaware and Mr. Katyal were arguing that the statute's extension to these instruments, what they call the disputed instruments here, whether or not those should in fact whether it should be extended to these instruments. And in doing so, I think I would summarize, although he never used this word, I would summarize it as he was saying it's not practically necessary to have the 2503 extend to these instruments, because the purpose of the statute was to avoid the increased costs of collecting addresses. And so what we were saying is that we don't want to force collection of addresses in MoneyGrams in order to figure out where they get distributed, and money orders or traveler's checks, because to do so, principally if they are small dollar transactions, would increase the cost of the product itself in a way that would be detrimental to the market for that product. And so his concern was really about this purpose of finding a way to handle these things without adding on requirements of addresses. Whereas in this case, we have high dollar amounts that are at issue. And so even though the addresses were not transmitted to MoneyGram here, they were collected by the banks. And you could have an easy solution, according to Mr. Katyal, which would be that we either by state statute require that these addresses get transmitted to MoneyGram so they know who to send it off to, and you just get back to the 2503 general rule that it goes to the state where the creditor lies, or the market should be able to figure this out and work it out and create those addresses themselves. So I think he's really focused on the history of what to determine what a money order should be, that it should be a limited category, principally because the money orders that were at focus here were the kind of small transactions to unbanked individuals that had often had no designated party. Indeed, the address issue could be solved with this narrow interpretation with just other language. And I think he also said narrow is best because it serves Congress's purposes. At the same time, it avoids the common law being displaced here, because the common law rule, if we read this larger, you would have a much broader application of displacement of common law, which is what 2503 expressly did. And then he's also concerned, Delaware is also concerned about the idea of an onslaught of litigation that would happen, that would disrupt these past transactions if you were to have it. Then Solicitor General Brawney came and he is really arguing for a broader interpretation of what 2503 means, and that it should capture more than just these small amount transactions to unbanked individuals, but the history of the word money order actually is those issued by non-financial as well as financial institutions, that you should look beyond the labels of money order as well. And so money orders can be anything really that are sold at financial or non-financial institutions, are not drawing directly on those institutions. So in other words, they're purchased. There's a distinction between banknotes, which are the bank issues it and it gets drawn directly out of the bank instead of a customer coming in and purchasing something. Anything where the bank is simply an agent of the distributing organization. So here in these cases, the bank is actually an agent of MoneyGram. They are not the one principally responsible for delving out the money. And as a consequence, it's not drawn on the bank. And so anything that has that characteristic should also be a money order. And where the bank is not a party to the transaction, they're really just kind of facilitating as an agent between MoneyGram and the customer purchasing the product and getting it to another party. And so if that's the case, you do that. And what Brawney really is saying is a different purpose argument. It's not about the Congress wasn't concerned about the transaction amount, but transaction cost by increasing the collection of addresses. What Congress was really concerned about was this equitable distribution, and they wouldn't want the concentration of these kinds of industries in one state to mean that one state gets all the escheated property. And so very similar, I think he's, although he never specifically mentions Powell's dissent, I think that's really a big area of focus there.
So depending on which side ends up winning out, I know you said that that there's no strong indication one way or the other, but either way that it could go, what impact would that decision have? Like, are there kind of similar situations where, choosing either the equity argument, and kind of broadening the congressional statute, or reading it more strictly, is there a similar situation where that kind of dichotomy could play out in the future that would we would look back on this case and go, well, that was kind of the turning point or the tell?
Yeah, I mean, there is a the mode of interpretation that we will use for identifying similarity. I think if we go to say that other similar instruments can be informed by the purpose of the statute itself, that can open up a purposivism a can of worms that could lead to really kind of injecting a lot of additional material into statutes that's not in the text of the statute. And so I think from a textual perspective, there could be some concern if the purposes of the statute are used to heavily inform the use of the word similar. Given that Congress likes to put in these catch-all provisions, which they sometimes do just as, there was even an argument in the oral argument that, well, they just did it just in case. They weren't sure that there was anything else out there, so they just threw in this, and we wanted to apply to anything else similar, but they didn't really know what, if there were anything similar, and if that sloppiness is can be problematic, especially if we are punting to the courts to do this. I do think that there is, there's always a question of when there's lack of clarity in a statute, whether or not The court should be conservative in its application, narrower in its application, so that Congress can be the one to expand if necessary. And you may see some themes of that coming in, which will inform, other statutory interpretation issues. What I think is also really interesting, and I would expect someone to mention here, is that Congress has proven that they can correct the court on this issue, because that's precisely what they did with 2503. It was responsive to a previous court action. So I do think that there are other instances where Congress has passed statutes responsive to court action, and that is a kind of special category of interpretation, I think, and we may see some insights on how that should be accomplished. But the one thing I think it does show is that this is an area where the court might be willing to take an approach where they say, well, if we get it wrong, Congress knows how to correct us, and they've done that before. And I think that's more likely to then ask the court to consider what how broad did Congress intend this to be? There's also some claims that there's other property escheating to the state, or possibly escheating to the state, which is not covered by this statute. There's been some rumblings that this case could affect that broader category of what escheats to the state. But I think because 2503 has such specific language and clearly does not apply to some of the other areas of controversy, where we have other kinds of abandoned property, including other kinds of abandoned checks that clearly are not within 2503. I just don't think it'll matter, because this will become a statutory interpretation case that those won't affect. I'll be curious as to whether or not they choose to talk about any broader federalism issues related to the equitable distribution of these assets across states. It's a curious area where, in terms of how we identify property, because it is something in which we want it to go to the ultimate property holders, and those are the creditors. And what should we care? How do we get it to them? Should animate some of this, and I do think that there's a possibility that we'll say, well, let's get it closer to the states, because that is another theme that I didn't mention at this point, is how do we get the property back to the creditors, if at all possible? Is it more likely to get back to them if it goes to the state of the purchase rather than in the state of, just a general goes and gets all concentrated in one state? That's often seen as a goal in property law. Again, this wasn't in the oral argument at all, and I don't think it was covered very deeply in the briefs, but it is a goal of property law to even, to get this property back to the creditors if possible. And we're kind of calling it abandoned, but it's not truly abandoned yet, because there is some opportunity for the creditors to still make claims even on this unclaimed property. So unclaimed is a little different than abandoned, and I apologize if I use those things too coterminously at times.
Well, thank you for the forecast and the clarifications. That was all very very interesting. I think we're probably getting towards the end of our time, so I want to give you the opportunity, if you have any kind of final takeaways from the case or anything you wanted to kind of leave the audience with as we get to the end of our episode here.
I think it's just a case that you shouldn't ignore, even if you're not interested in the particular facts of the case. Again, because of the themes I mentioned at the top of the program, I do think that the opinions are likely to be more interesting than the facts. With that, I hope that you will be searching for, and I hope we'll all learn some things generally about how the court resolves statutory ambiguities, and how it deals with lists in statutes, and lists with catch-alls. And I think there will be broader applications of this, even if they're not directly stated. You should look for indirect cues that may come for the interpretation of other statutes as a result of how this 503 gets interpreted.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Koshin, and it's always good to talk with you. And this case certainly seems now more interesting than it did at first blush. So thank you for talking with us today about that. I hope the audience feels the same way. And thank you all for tuning into SCOTUS Cast. Keep an eye on our website for upcoming episodes. We have an interesting term to cover, and we hope to see you through and see you again.
Thanks again.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. SCOTUS Cast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUS Cast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.